The Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Hello, everyone. Happy Sunday as this summer is coming to a close, unfortunately, although it doesn't feel like I don't feel any fall in the air, which is good. We have a great show. It's going to be a little bit shorter than usual. And as always, we'll be taking your legal questions at 6 o'clock. I know a lot of you have interesting questions about your workplace situation with COVID, going back to school, going back to college, what's happening with that. If you have legal questions pertaining to that, I'm happy to take your call. And we'll be doing that right around 6 o'clock, 312-981-7200. But let's get right to it. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the trial of Charles Manson. That's the convicted murderer and cult leader whose followers committed a series of 9 murders at 4 different locations in the late 1960s. Among the victims, the beautiful actress Sharon Tate, who was the pregnant wife of Roman Polanski. Crimes were committed by a group of hippies, I guess I could call them, living in a commune under the influence of one Charles Manson. And you might have seen a new documentary called Helter Skelter, an American Myth, a very, very good documentary on this issue, probably the best that's ever been out. And it prominently features my guest, Ivor Davis, an author of the book Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder. Welcome back to the show, Ivor. How are you?
Thank you very well, Karen. Nice to be back with you in Chicago.
You know, this story will never go away. Like many serial killers and spree killers, people are constantly fascinated. What do you think? I mean, you covered this case right from the beginning. You must have been about 5 years old. And you covered it start to finish. What about this case gave it such legs and makes it so fascinating?
Well, actually, I should correct you. I was 6 and a half years old at the time. but seriously, I was a foreign correspondent for a big London newspaper called the London Daily Express. And I was covering the big stories. And I went out on the very first day that we learned that several people had been murdered, but we didn't know who it was. Now, to answer your question directly, Karen, I think the fact that Sharon Tate was a beautiful actress, a new Marilyn Monroe, and she was pregnant, and she was married to a famous film director called Roman Polanski. That actually captured our imagination. And then the other thing that did on this horrendous crime was the fact that they all lived in a very comfortable, safe neighborhood in Beverly Hills, off one of the canyons. And somehow that shocked everybody, because somehow, I don't know why, but we think that murders take place in working class neighborhoods. Not the case with this one. So with a high profile movie actress and a high profile hairdresser called Jay Sebring, and the absolute fascination with Charles Manson and his band of, as you mentioned, hippies, but they were runaway girls. They were unhappy women who thought they found nirvana under Manson's awful influence.
You know, when we see serial killers, the Gacys of the world and the Dahmers and the Golden State Killers, we see patterns, okay? We see that they stalk their victims and their victims may have some similarities and they take trophies and these types of things. And we see spree killers too. But Charles Manson was kind of one of his own. I mean, first of all, for people who didn't follow the story or don't know the story, you know, he did not, contrary to what some believe, he was never a murderer himself. He did not actually kill anybody. He was the one who, according to the prosecutors, masterminded and influenced all of this ragtag kind of motley group of people to do the crimes. What can you just describe a little bit for our listeners who may not be as familiar? What was the motive? What caused Manson to get these people to do these bizarre and horrific crimes?
I should explain with my answer this, that Manson became a puppet master for these women. He'd grown up in prisons. He was a small guy. He survived the juvenile hall, rough juvenile prisons. And of course, when he came out, you've got to remember this happened in 1969, 68. And when he came out, he suddenly realized that this was the era of free love, free sex, drugs, LSD, and suddenly a kind of bell went off in his skull, And he thought, wow, I'm going to tell these women what they want to hear, because he was educated in prison. So he found these runaway, disenchanted young women and amazingly was able to almost brainwash them with all sorts of things about love, using the Bible, using Beatle music, and they were ripe for the plucking. And they felt that this man who could tell them, who within 10 minutes could tell them what was wrong with them, why they hated their mother, their father, whoever they hated, and he was the answer. And he was a cult leader. I mean, I would just add this one thing. Look at what happened with the guy, and I forget his name now, who made several hundred people swallow Kool-Aid poison. Right. So Manson found a little niche, and he was right for the times, and he was right for the young women who were, most of them were fairly from well-to-do homes, and he just managed to capture their brains with a little help from LSD and other mind-altering drugs, which he handed out to them at the Spahn movie ranch where they lived outside L.A. like candies. So Manson realized this was the way he could control the women.
It was I'm sorry, but you said he was a little man. He was 5'2". He wasn't particularly good looking. I don't know how intelligent he was, but he just doesn't strike you as that charismatic guy who gets people to do his bidding. Not to mention that these women, although they seem to be kind of drifters, they weren't necessarily evil people. But what they ended up doing was hellacious. I mean, bloody and horrible. And it's just still amazing to me that this guy, with whatever influence he had, got these somewhat normal people to do something that was completely outrageous.
He listened, he spoke, and they believed what he said. And that's part of the, the psychologist's reasoning for why a cult leader is able to do it. And he was a cult leader. He used his own special thing that he learned in jail, how to win friends and influence people, and all that kind of chicory pokery stuff that was fed to him in jail. And he came out, and he was absolutely perfect for the period, for the time, for the disenchantment, for the Vietnam War, for young people who were looking for the meaning of life. And to them, Charles Manson presented the meaning of life. I mean, that's a simple, silly, almost basic reason for why he enchanted them. And he was, as I said earlier, he was the puppet master who knew every string to pull to make them do what he wanted them to do.
He was also a racist. He believed that that there was going to be a race war. And although I don't believe any of his victims were African-American, I could be wrong on that. You're going to tell me. That was a big part of his beliefs.
Yes, he was a racist, and none of his victims were black. However, his whole modus operandi was for himself to get these women to do his bidding, and he became a master at that. It's hard to believe, but as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, Karen, if you watch that program on Epix called Helter Skelter, which is done by a brilliant film director, Oscar-winning filmmaker called Leslie Chilcott, you will see how he grew up an unhappy young man in jail. But not all of us, or not all the people who are unhappy in childhood, end up becoming mass murderers. So what I like about the program is it's one of the best I've seen, and I've seen them all, but it explains Manson's background and what the horrible appeal was that Manson had over him. It was such a compelling Machiavellian way that he handled these young, mostly women.
You know what, we're going to, can you stay with us? I think we're going to move into the next segment with you, if that's okay. And I just want to ask one question before we go to a break. Do you think that, I mean, the case was tried, it was a long trial, correct? It was like, did it go a full year?
Almost a year, absolutely, yes.
And all the antics that were going on, and one of the things, I guess what I want to do when we come back, Let's talk about the trial. I want to talk about how Manson conducted himself, whether you thought that he was doing this just to act crazy, to maybe get some sort of advantage, or he just liked the theater of it all, or was he really crazy? And did this, was it possible perhaps to have won his case? Could a good lawyer with a client who just kept his mouth shut have been acquitted of these crimes, with the idea being, how in the world did this guy get a bunch of people to do crimes for no apparent reason? And when we come back with Ivor Davis, we are going to talk about that. He is the author of Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder. You're listening to WGN.
You love the world you live in.
Most assuredly, it's me.
You love all the pain that you've caused people, all the anguish you've
caused. Oh, I don't know pain. I don't know pain. I have no depth of pain. I have no depth of suffering. I don't know ridicule. I don't know all the bad things. I haven't been punished by you all my life since I was 10 years old. I've been in every reform school you got across the country and used to lay down and have to get my ass whipped till I couldn't walk. Tell me about some pain.
And that's our fault. That's all those people
want. No fault. Make strong, good pain. Understand pain. Not bad.
That was an interview with Charles Manson from 60 Minutes Australia. Thank you for that. I'm here with author Ivor Davis, who wrote the book Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder. Welcome back. You were at the trial, is that right?
I was. I covered the trial from start to finish, yes.
Can you just tell the listeners a little bit about how the trial was conducted and how Manson conducted himself? And whether you thought it was intentional or he was just crazy?
How the trial was conducted was, it was not conducted in the traditional way you and I and many people know trials are. I had covered the Patricia Hearst trial. I covered the Sirhan trial. And this was the most insane trial I've ever covered. I think what happened was this, that Manson somehow decided he needed to defend himself. Well, of course, the judge finally ruled that he was not competent to defend himself. So then Manson decreed and said he was going to turn the trial into a total circus. And he did it. And he did it in many ways. I want to tell you that whenever I showed up for a trial, with Manson there and the girls, I didn't know what would happen because it was unpredictable. There was one occasion when Manson shaved his head and carved a swastika. The girls who were on trial with him did the same. There was a time when Charles Manson started singing and the girls did. And there was a time when Charles Manson, with a sharp pencil, jumped at the judge and said, "I'm going to kill you, old man." And it was grabbed by one of the bailiffs in a rugby tackle. So nothing went in the normal, traditional way of a trial. And I think Manson deliberately did that. But in my opinion, it worked against him, because Vincent Bugliosi, the chief DA prosecutor, was telling the jury that this man had control of the women and told them what to do and go out and kill. And there he was, months later, sitting in a court, and the jury could see that he manipulated them. He handled them. Whatever he did, they did. And I think it worked against him. And the other amazing thing, and you as a lawyer could possibly comment on that, is that Manson did never testify in his own defense. And as a result, he ordered the girls not to do the same. And one other thing I must tell you, that Manson did testify in the trial, but not within earshot of the jury. And I want to tell you that he spoke without notes for an hour. And then when the judge said, "Would you like to repeat your testimony in front of the jury?" Manson said, "No, I've said what I want to say." So he wanted to turn it into a circus. He hired a most obstreperous lawyer who went on and on forever. And the whole case and the lawyers that were hired, except for maybe one exception, were fairly, well, I'm going to say this, they were incompetent. One guy who handled the girl had never handled a traffic ticket. He was fresh out of UCLA law school. His name was Ronald Hughes, and halfway through the case, he disappeared and was found dead 3 months later. So the most amazing, amazing trial I've ever attended, and Manson was in control of this circus.
Well, and I think, you know, again, and this is just me thinking as a lawyer, that if he, let's just say that you dressed him up in a suit, got his hair cut, didn't have him shaving his head, didn't have him ranting and raving, and had a lawyer who was good and he was complying with his lawyer's direction, this was a case that could have been won. Because how do you convince a jury that this guy convinced these women, who maybe weren't even believable because they were so brainwashed and they were so, you know, they were drifters and maybe they didn't have a lot of credibility in front of a jury. How do you convince 12 people beyond a reasonable doubt that he caused those murders? It could have been won, I think. You know, again, I wasn't there. I was quite young. So I just feel like this was his own doing. It was his own undoing that he ended up in jail. And almost thank God that happened, because we wouldn't have wanted the Manson. We wouldn't have the likes of Manson out of prison.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Manson behaved like a crazy man, and as a result, the jury decided he was a crazy man, and he did influence the women to do what he said he told them to do. So if he'd done all the things, dressed up in a suit, behaved himself, that would have been very different. And I'll just add one kicker to that, if I may, Karen. Unfortunately, the main killer who went to the Sharon Tate house and went to the LaBianca's house was a guy called Charles Tex Watson. He was in Texas, incarcerated, fighting extradition. I believe that if Charles Tex Watson had been tried with the girls and Manson, a good lawyer for Manson would have said, Charles Tex Watson, he led the killers. He was the one. I'm innocent. I'm not really to blame. And if he had been tried at the same time as the girls, and he was tried separately and convicted separately, if it had happened the same day and Manson had behaved himself, we would have had, strangely and bizarrely, a different, totally outcome.
So Manson died in 2017 at the age of 83. Only the good die young, proof thereof. What happened? Susan Atkins, one of the killers, is dead. Some of them are alive. Are any of them contrite? Are any of them change their mind and say, like, this shouldn't have happened and I'm sorry for it and I was out of my mind? Or are they still believing in what they did?
All of the above that you just outlined, Karen, they all they apologize, they do whatever they can, they have become Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Kremwinkel have become the perfect inmates and have tried to get parole. So they have apologized at every parole hearing. Every 4 years or so, they show up at a parole hearing, and the parole board are impressed, and the parole board said, yes, they should be paroled. And then the governor of California, whoever he happens to be, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the current governor say, no way are we letting these young women out. They're no longer young women, of course. They're now older women, much older women. So it's like almost a charade. They get parole, but then they are denied parole, and they're in jail right now as we speak, as is Charles Tex Watson. So nothing happens. They go through this, and I don't think they will ever get out of jail.
Now, Squeaky Fromm was, if that name rings a bell to the listeners, she was not one of the defendants charged, but she was one of the harem. She was one of the girls who were in this commune, and you might remember her name because subsequently she tried to assassinate President Gerald Ford. And she was incarcerated for that crime, and she's out of jail, isn't she?
She is out of jail because she was charged with, as you said, trying to kill President Gerald Ford. The awful thing, the amazing thing, as we talk today in the year 2020, Squeaky Frommy, I think she calls herself Frommy, she is still a devotee of Charles Manson. She lives somewhere on the East Coast. She, I think, has changed her name a bit, and she's a much older woman. But she followed, I think almost, some people say that Charles Manson said, do something to bring my case to highlight it with the international and the national press. And so she went and she pulled a gun out, and she claimed the gun wasn't loaded or the bullets weren't in there, but she did have a gun, and the Secret Service jumped on her, arrested her, and then, as you said, She was released on parole, and she's kept a pretty low profile today, wherever she is. But she still believes in Manson.
So did are you saying that Manson had something to do with her trying to assassinate Gerald Ford?
I think what happened was that she went to see Charles Manson very frequently. She was worried about the environment, and she claims that she took this step to try and bring attention to the damaged environment that was going on. However, I would guess that, and I know that she went to see Manson all the time, very frequently, and even though she wasn't allowed in to see him, she communicated with him and lived in the town wherever Manson was imprisoned, whether it was in Northern California, Central California, she was there. She was one of his devoted bands of followers, even to his very death. And I think I'm pretty sure that she went to his funeral. So she was still there, and she kept in touch with him, and she is a believer to this day.
Ivor Davis, thank you so much for joining us. Ivor Davis is an author, and he wrote the book Manson Exposed, A Reporter's 50-Year Journey into Madness and Murder. And please see him in this 6-part documentary called Helter Skelter, An American Myth, where he's been interviewed extensively on his coverage of this case. Thank you so much for joining us, and take care.
Thank you, Karen.